Tonight we will come to the last of six sermons that are meant to help us understand the meaning of Jesus. And what I want to do now, tonight, is to put the whole thing right at the front. And here's how I'm going to do that. Just say three things. Jesus was born to set us free. Jesus lived his whole life to set us free. And Jesus died his death to set us free. Those three statements are about Jesus, about what he did. They're also statements about us. If they're true, it means that each one of us is not free until Jesus frees us. Now, I know that some of you in here believe that and experience it, and maybe others don't. But I want to start by asking you to think for a moment of a person that you know who is not free. Someone who's trapped, whose life has them all tied up. Do you know somebody like that? It may be you as I speak, and if it's you, I'm sure glad that you're here, because tonight is good news for you. It may be someone that you love. It may be a son or a daughter, a son-in-law. It may be a neighbor, a friend. For me, when I was in junior high, my best friend was not free. And it wasn't something that I could put into words then, but in retrospect, I remember what it was like to be around him. His name was Jason. He was a skateboarder, and that was what my entire life revolved around. It used to be video games, but then I got a skateboard, and those went away, and it was skateboarding. I used to go to Jay's house, and we would skate out front, and it was great. He was a lot of fun. We got in trouble in school. We were like best friends. And when I arrived at his house, I can remember that something changed from when we were outside, and then when we went inside, it was different. His house was dark. It smelled kind of weird. And I never saw his parents, and when I did, which was very rarely, I could tell that he was afraid of them. I found out 20 years later that his parents were addicted to drugs and alcohol. His father sold drugs, that he lived in constant fear at home. I love my friend. It's hard for me to tell the story. I didn't know it then, but he was not free at home. He was a prisoner. And some people that we know are like that. He graduated high school, and he got away from home as far as he could, but there was one thing that he did not get away from when he left high school, and it was drugs. There was a lot of pain for him being out of that home, I'm sure, because of the hole that was in his heart because of his parents, and so he got into drugs, and it started small, and it got worse and worse, and I stopped seeing him as a friend, but I heard stories about him that he'd gotten into heroin, and he started to steal, and he ended up going down to Florida to get away from it, and then he got in trouble and went all the way up to Boston, and then the next thing I'd heard, he was out somewhere in the middle of our country, and I don't know geography well enough to know any of the names out there. He was out there. And I would get emails from him now and then, and my brother did too. And you could just tell from his emails that he was away from home, but he was still not free. Now he was stuck because of a lot of bad decisions he made. Stealing, getting into drugs, hurting a whole string of people, but he was still searching for freedom. Fast forward about 2.5 years, I get an email out of nowhere. It was around this time last year, actually 2 years back. And it said in the subject line, "Christian, the email that I've been waiting to send you." He knew I was a Christian all along. He knew that I believed what I said at the start, which is that Jesus was born to set us free. Jesus lived each day of his life to set us free. And Jesus died to set us free. Jesus did all of that for us. And I always knew he did that for my friend Jason. I wanted my friend to believe that. In the email he said, "Christian, brother," and he had, in the email he called himself Jason. His name had been changed to Osel along the way. He had become a monk, a Buddhist or something. I don't remember, but Osel. I like Jason better, but Osel's not a bad name. But he said, listen to this. He said, "I ended up in prison in Arizona. And here, one of the inmates opened the Bible, and he read to me, and God finally saved me. All these years I've been running from him, trying to save myself. All these years I've run all the way across the country, trying every way to set myself free, and I had to go to jail to finally be freed." And there was so much levity in his email. There was joy, even though he was literally imprisoned. If it's not true that Jesus lived and was born and died to set my friend free, then I'm not sure who Jesus could help. But I stand here this evening, and what I want to say as clearly as I can to all of us is that if we want to understand the meaning of Jesus, and that's what we've been considering together over these last 6 weeks, then what we have to hear quite simply is how it is that Jesus frees us. And the way we're going to do that this afternoon is to look at one single sentence of his. If you were here last week, I led right up to this, and then I said I'm going to talk about this in the next week. And that's what we're going to consider tonight. If you want to look in your own Bible, if you find Matthew chapter 20, in verse 28, there's a single statement that Jesus makes about himself. And this is it. We're just going to look at this tonight. And here's what I want you all to do. If you already are a believer and you have your mind all made up about Christ, listen still, because I'm sure there's something more for you to learn. If you're not sure what you believe, you're here with a family member, listen so that you can hear what Christians are meant to organize themselves around, who this Jesus is, what Jesus actually means. In his own words, in the Gospel of Matthew in verse 28, Jesus says what I would call the most concise statement about who he is that comes out of his own mouth. And it comes when he says these words. They're up there on the screen. He said to the disciples this: "The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Now, I'll admit that in our ears, when we hear them right away, these words might not sound especially meaningful. But to those disciples that were gathered together at that moment when Jesus first said them, they came very powerfully to them. This is just a little backstory, and I'm going to spend only a short time on this because I talked about this last week. Jesus said this when he was with his friends, and he had just told them that he was going to go to the cross and die. Right after that, they started having a discussion about which one of them was the best. They wanted to have positions of prominence in relation to him. They wanted to be great. Jesus couldn't believe that so quickly their minds ran to which one of them mattered the most, and that's when he said this. And what he was doing in this moment was putting their attention on himself and showing them what they needed to see about him to correct their wrong ideas about where greatness was. And that's when he added this statement that the Son of Man came to give his life a ransom for many. And I want to narrow our focus even more for this afternoon on this single word here, ransom. This is a word that Jesus uses to describe who he is, in terms of what he was going to do for those disciples, and not just them, but for the world. And what I want to do with you is to take you through, very simply, the meaning of this word and unfold it for you in a way that you will see Jesus and you will see yourself. Before I get into that, I want you now not to think of that other person who's trapped, but look honestly at yourself for a moment. Do you see any way in your own life right now where you yourself are not free? Anything at all? I know we're accustomed to push those things out of our minds because it's hard to think about ways that you're not free, but let them come in for a moment. It might be a relationship. It might be something that you've done in the past or something that was done to you. It might be an oppressive feedback signal from the musicians. Listen, I know that there are people who are in here right now who hear me who are very aware of the fact that they're not free. The word ransom is a word that you and I know when there's a kidnapping or a hostage situation. The word ransom would have been a bit more full for the first hearers of it, and I want to tell you what they heard when they heard it. First of all, the New Testament was written in Greek, and the Greek word for ransom is lutron. And that's a translation of an Aramaic word, because those folks spoke Aramaic, and the word was barnasha. I've got that wrong. That was not the Aramaic word. Scratch that. I don't know what the Aramaic word was. Who cares? All right? The Greek word is lutron, and it's a compound word. And the first part of lutron is luo. And that's a verb that means to loose, to untie something that's bound up, to take something that's got restrictions on it. It's all wound up and it's not free to move, and to do what needs to be done to take that apart. That's what the verb luo means. And then the suffix of that word, tron, the definition of that word is means of. So when you put luo and tron together, lutron, you have the word that means the means of loosening, the instrument by which something is freed. The way that something is completely constricted and bound up is taken from that state of not being free at all and put in the position of altogether being freed. And that's what ransom means. Now, in their world, they would not have immediately thought of kidnapping, which maybe is what we think of when we think of ransom. They would have thought of principally three situations in which ransom would be required. And here they are. They're very simple. The first is in the situation where there were prisoners of war. If one people group overthrew another, one of the things that they would do is they would capture the citizens of that land and take them captive, and then if the other side wanted them back, they would have to give money to free their prisoners, and that money was called ransom. It was the way, it was the means of loosening those people from their imprisonment. A second situation that would require ransom would be the case where there was a bond servant. And this is a social situation that we don't have in our own country, but in some forms we might. It happened that now and then someone would make some bad decisions and get into financial trouble. And the only option they had to solve their problem was essentially to sell themselves into servitude to a wealthy person. They would come to someone and say, if you give me this much money, I'll be your servant. And then they would send that money back to their family to help their family out. Because of the bad decisions they made, that was all they could do. And in that situation, once a person was in that kind of servitude, if someone who had enough money came along and chose to give that money to the person who owned that individual, they could be freed. And that money also was called ransom. And then the third was, very simply, slavery. If a person was either stolen and then sold into slavery or was born into it, if a benevolent person from the outside who had enough money came along, they could purchase that person's freedom with ransom money. They could come and give enough money to get that person out. Those were the three situations: prisoners of war, bondservant, or slave. Got it? Now, I said just a moment ago that we don't have these kinds of situations in our own day. But the truth about every person that you'll ever meet, including all of you in here, is that in one way or another, we experience daily some form of this kind of bondage that I've just described. And some of you know it. Try this on. All around us, there are prisoners of war. In our environment, many people suffer because of things that have been done to them by a power that is as strong as a foreign army, that has come into their life and done something wicked and wrong against them, and now they're trapped and their entire lives are lived from this day forward in response to that bad thing that that power over there did to them. And they might as well be prisoners, even though literally they may be free. My friend Jason was a prisoner of war in his own home. Maybe some of you know that. Maybe some of you have a friend or someone that was close to you who did something wrong to you back in the past and they're not friends anymore, but now you still live as if you're imprisoned by that bad thing they did to you. Some of you have been in relationships that keep you, even now, though they're in the past, like you're a prisoner. Yes? Many of us are bondservants to the mistakes that we've made in the past. Yeah, we haven't perhaps sold ourselves to wealthy people to have enough money to support our families, but aren't there many of us who, when we look at our lives and where we are right now, we see that we're trapped because of mistakes we've made in the past? Maybe some choice that we made that we look back and we wish we hadn't, but there it is in our past, and right now, because of it, we're stuck and we can't move freely, we're tied up. We might as well be owned by someone else because of those things we've done. Maybe it was in a relationship that broke down. Maybe it was a bad business decision. Maybe we got into some crazy practice to try to support our family because we were very sick and... never mind. That was a reference at a show. Okay, keep going. Many people, I'll say this lastly, many people, even in here, are so trapped by patterns of behavior and attitudes and actions that they might as well be slaves. Drugs are not the only kinds of masters that keep people enslaved. There's all kinds of addictions that people suffer from. When we look honestly at ourselves and at the world around us, we may have to admit that even though many people in our own country, which is a tremendously good place, enjoy so many freedoms, the truth is that many of us are stuck and are bound and are not free. Whether it's from some strong power that overwhelms us like an army, or some bad choices that we've made that have us stuck, or some master in the present that owns us like a slave master would own a slave. The people all around us are enslaved and trapped. Now, this statement of Jesus here, this word that he spoke back then, is a word also to us today, to every one of us who experiences in one way or another a prison. And I want to push it even further now and ask you to follow me even deeper. Because if I've described the prisons that my friend experienced and many of you have experienced in such a way that there is a solution out there, if only families behaved better, if only there weren't so many social ills, if only people tried harder or learned a little bit more or worked more than they ever have at setting things right, well, then maybe we could all be free. But that's actually not the truth. If you ask the scriptures, if you come to the Bible and you say, is there anything that unites all of the prisons that people find themselves in? Is there anything that keeps together the variety of prisons that even you out here feel? The Bible says, yes, there's one thing that's beneath all of those prisons. And do you know what it is? I heard someone say it. It's sin. Now, that's a word that's wildly misunderstood in our day and misrepresented. Maybe I could put it to you like this. The thing that keeps people trapped is there the distance between them and God. So long as any one of us is separated from God, and that's what sin is, it's the thing that has us on a path away from God, down our own road, away from Him, and therefore into misery, into prisons. That's beneath every prison that anyone experiences, whether it's an addiction, whether it's a shame because of who they think they are, whether it's some failure that haunts them, or some situation that they find themselves in right now that they're afraid of. Deep beneath all of those troubles, the scriptures say, is one simple problem, and it's the distance between men and women and God. It's sin. And now Jesus comes, and he says to these disciples, the Son of Man has come, not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus is talking about you and me. I want to go deeper for a moment in this concept of ransom. In every situation where ransom is involved, there are always at least, and probably more, three components. All right? You ready for this? Yeah? I need some help here. You ready?
Yes.
Okay, good. The first component in every situation is the captivity. The thing which holds the person trapped. We've talked about that. The second component is the Redeemer. Now, that word sounds religious to you, doesn't it? And not just because I have a tie on today, which is pretty unusual. It sounds religious because we're in here, but let me tell you, that word originally is not a religious word. Redeem simply means to buy back. The Latin or Old French word redeem, it means just that. To buy again or to buy back. And in every ransom situation, not only is there a person who's captive, but there's a redeemer, someone who comes to buy that individual back. That's the second component. And then there's a third, and it's the cost. How much is the freedom of that other one worth to the redeemer? Are you with me? In any situation back then, if a village's people were captured by that other stronger village and they wanted to get them back, they would have to decide who's going to bring the money, and how much are those people worth? You follow me? Who's going to be the one to go redeem them, and how much should we give to take them back? In this situation here, in the one that we are looking at in the moment, in the one that Jesus describes, the Redeemer is quite obviously him. And I want you to know that in this passage, we have a hint that teaches us a bit more about who he is that we often gloss over. I went over it last week really quickly. I read the words, the Son of Man, and I said, that's just Jesus' way of saying himself. But does that phrase seem a little weird to anybody else? Does it? No? Kind of, right? What does that mean, Son of Man? Remember before I said it's an Aramaic word, Barnasha? That's this word. I got ahead of myself. It happens sometimes. The Son of Man is a Greek phrase that when Jesus said it in their ears would have reminded them of a title that they had heard long before. And listen now, it doesn't do that for us maybe, but I want to tell you what they heard when they heard him say that, because he's not just saying me, he's also saying something about himself. Have you heard of the prophet Daniel? Some of you know that. If you don't know who the prophet Daniel was, generations before Jesus came, there was a man named Daniel who was a dreamer. He had visions in his mind, and they came from God. In one of them, this is in the 7th chapter of the book of Daniel, he lied down at night to have a rest. And as his body fell off to sleep, his mind was active, and he had a vision. And it's amazing. You can read this in Daniel chapter 7. There he finds himself up, looking out over a seascape, the land on one side, and there the wind begins to blow. The water is whipped up, and now out of the ocean there arises a beast. And it's a terrifying dream. There, the first beast, I forget the exact order. It's something like a lion with eagle's wings. The next beast that comes out of the water, it's a second one. It's a leopard, and it has like spikes coming out all over the place. The third one is another crazy animal, and I don't even remember the fourth. Does anybody else know this vision? It's filled with weird stuff. Scary stuff. 10 horns, one's got eyes on it. All of these beasts arise out of the ocean and they go up onto the land, and there on the land there are thrones, and on one of the thrones is the Ancient of Days. This is a figure that is clothed in white with a great woolly white beard that's as white as snow. Any guesses who that is? It's God the Father there. And now there's one throne that's not occupied. And as Daniel sees this vision with these terrifying beasts that are there only to wreak havoc, listen, that are there only to steal freedom from humanity, that are there only to keep people trapped, to make their lives miserable, that are there only to make people think that there's no hope for them, they're always going to be stuck in this place, that life is altogether bad, that they're always going to be running from their problems and always running into worse problems. As they are there, another one comes. And this one comes on the clouds, and he is glorious. This figure comes and sits on the throne before the Ancient One, and the Ancient One looks at him in such a way that makes it plain that this figure has all authority and will be given all power and all dominion, and he will rule over the world and destroy those beasts utterly for all time, and they will have no more power. And guess who Daniel says that one is? Son of Man. Now, if you and I were around in those days when Daniel had that vision, we would know, as we heard it described, that those beasts are all of the misery that we find ourselves in. And that this vision was given to this man, Daniel, to give some hope for this, that one day God would send a mighty figure who would come and destroy the beasts that had been stealing all of the freedom that people were meant to have. That one day the Son of Man would come and rescue us. And that hope lived in the people of Israel for many generations. History made it hard for them to believe it because the life of the Jews was very, very hard. And that rolled on all the way until Jesus' day. And you know, even in Jesus' day, there were still people having dreams and visions. Maybe you've heard the word Apocrypha. Have you heard that? Have some of you heard that? We have the Old Testament scriptures, we call them, and then the New Testament. In between those two, there were other books that were being written, other visions. One of them is called 4th Ezra. In the 30th chapter of that book, there's a vision that's almost the same as the one that Daniel has. This time, the prophet falls off to sleep, and instead of the wind just blowing and whipping up the sea and a man appearing out of the clouds, this time the water is pushed up by the waves until the water itself turns into a man. And that man emerges from the sea, and now he stands on the land and takes his own two hands, and he takes a hold of the ground and builds a mountain for himself, and he stands atop it. And now when the beasts appear, they come before him with all of their hordes who are aligned against the goodness of God. They stand before this man of the sea who's up on the mountains, and they're about to attack, and he doesn't have a weapon, he doesn't have a sword, he only opens his mouth, and fire comes out of his mouth and his lips, and then a stream of sparks shoots out of his tongue. It sounds to me like, what's that show that our kids like too much? Power Rangers. It's quite a vision. And guess what Ezra says this one is called? The Son of Man. You are with Jesus. You're walking along with him. And you know that you are not free, and the people around you are not free, and what you long for is freedom. And then you hear Jesus talking about going to the cross and dying, and what you think is, I'm sure this guy is the one to free us, but how could he possibly die? And then you say something crazy like, hey, when you become the king, can I have a part of your glory? And then he turns and he says to you this, the Son of Man came. Now he's talking about the Son of Man. And you think maybe for the first time when you're with him, wait a minute, maybe that power powerful figure that Daniel talked about all those years ago, and maybe that mighty, forceful man who can speak and breathe fire that Ezra talked about, maybe this guy is the one. And Jesus says, the Son of Man, and you know he's talking about himself, and you think, maybe he's the one who will overcome all of this dreadful wickedness, and he's the one who will ruin the powers that are against us. And then he goes on to say, came not to be served, but to serve. And you think, wait, how could that mighty figure be a servant of anyone? Everyone's supposed to serve him. And you know, for the first time, maybe it dawns on you that there is something more powerful than fire shooting out of your mouth. And maybe there's something more powerful than destroying your enemies with a scepter and a wicked power of force that can destroy them and turn them into ash and smoke, and that's all that's left. Maybe there's something stronger than that. You think of this for a moment, and you know what it is? It's love. You think for the first time, maybe the strongest thing in the world is not the might and force of power and strength, but it's love. It's tender love that gives itself and doesn't force another person over to make itself strong, but instead builds up the other by giving itself in this unbelievable and impossible, overwhelming kindness of love. And Jesus goes on to say, and to give his life as a ransom for many. And now that third thing about ransom. You have the captivity. You have the Redeemer. And now Jesus is saying, I'm him. And then you have the cost. And that very simply is, how much is the Redeemer willing to give in order to secure freedom for the one who's captive? And this is not just a question right now about Jesus and those disciples or some of the people back then. It's a question about you. You may feel it very strongly that you are captive. If you feel that right now, let me let you ask, if I'm captive to sin, if I'm completely stuck, and if Jesus is the Redeemer, what is he willing to give for me? And that is a question about your value in God's eyes. How valuable are you to him? In any situation where ransom is involved, it's a question of what is the value of the person who's captured. And it was like that back then. That's how it worked, and the disciples would have known that. And it's partly what makes Jesus' statement here so powerful. But stay with that idea for a moment. When there's a kidnapping, the person who's stolen the other has to try to get a sense for how much the one who wants that person back has and how much they're willing to give. And so it's a kind of betting game. You follow me? And that's how it was back then. In fact, in the ancient literature, when you look at stories in which there's ransom, it's plain that the ransom amount is never an objective fixed amount. It's always subjective. It's always dependent upon a couple of variables. How much money does the person who wants them back have? How valuable is that person to them? How brazen am I going to be when I ask for the money to get them back? Anyone here ever see the movie Ruthless People? Some of you have. This is an 80s movie. There were some good things in the 80s, weren't there? And in this movie, this captures it very well. In this movie, there's a working couple, and the woman in this couple, I think her name is Sandy, she comes up with a great fashion design, and what happens, which is very dreadful, is her boss, Sam Sneed, I think is his name, or Sam something or other, he steals her design, and he gets an enormous benefit from it, and they're so angry that they decide to get back at him, and so what they do is they kidnap his wife, and then call him up and with the meanest possible voice say, you give us $500,000 or your wife is going to be killed. You don't call the media or she's going to be killed. You don't call the police or she's going to be killed. Do you understand? Now, as a viewer, you're watching this man as he hears this. His smile gets bigger and bigger as it goes. And it turns out that he had been planning to murder his wife already and had been ready to spend a lot of money to do so. And now, so this is a great thing. And so, of course, he doesn't. Is this scandalous? It's a good movie, right? Some of us, listen now, some of us, and I know this, some of us who are Christians and have been for a long time, might look at ourselves and think that because of who we've been, because of what we've done, there's no question about it, that if there was a ransom call, God wouldn't give a thing for us. Many people that I've encountered who don't believe in God and are far from him, when they hear the story of Christian faith, they say, fine, good. It doesn't make me happy to hear your good stories about God, because of one thing, I'm absolutely certain, that if God is good, he doesn't want anything to do with me. I couldn't mean anything to him because of who I've been. And I imagine that even now there are people in this room who struggle with thoughts like that, that I'm just bad. I have to be honest. My friend Jason, I know one of the reasons he ran west further and further was because when he looked at himself, he thought he was worth nothing. And surely that was a result of the environment in which he grew. In this moment, Jesus turns to those friends of his, those disciples, and he says this about what the value of each person is, that the Son of Man came to give his life a ransom. And that means what he believes each one of us is worth is his very life. There is nothing more valuable than the life of God. But the story of Christian faith is that God himself came in Jesus, that he was born and found in the form of a real human being. On Christmas, God became a man and lived among us to be with us, to walk the path of true humanity with us, to know every step of what it looks like to be a man or a woman in this world, to know what it is to suffer loss and pain and difficulty and challenge, to know what it's like to be a captive. He himself was held captive. To do all of that for one end, and that is to set you and me free. And he has done that. So what does this mean? Now, I want you to listen very carefully now. First, I want to tell you what this means for you. It means that you are free, completely free. If there are things in your past that people have done to you that have made you miserable, you no longer have to suffer according to those failures of those others. You are completely free to leave them behind you and walk away. If you struggle and suffer because you're guilty and ashamed of the choices that you've made, you also are completely free to leave that behind. If you are enslaved to some addiction, to some pattern, to some action, to some behavior that you keep going back to over and over again, and you can't get away from it anymore, more than a person could get out of a prison cell that had bars of iron that were locked. Listen to me now. This means that the bars are open and you are completely free to walk right out of there. You have no reason to stay. You may choose again and again to go back. You may look at yourself and say, well, I've decided that I'm no good, and you put yourself right back in that prison cell. But hear me now. At every moment, now and on until the future, you are completely free to leave because the doors are open. Do you hear me? And that means you are altogether liberated, and you no longer have to suffer from all of those things. And when you look at yourself, here's a second thing this means about you, and you say, what am I worth? And you look at the people around you and the way they treat you, and it makes you feel low. And you look at yourself, and you know all of the things that you've done wrong, and the way you look at yourself, and you feel even lower. Then you must remember that Jesus Christ, the Son of Man, the one who is the Redeemer from all time, who came out of heaven, he thinks I'm worth his very life. And that should make you glad. That's what it means for you. And then one last thing. Because it doesn't just mean something for you, it means something for the people around you as well. For some of you, when I started and I said, do you know anybody who's not free? Get that person in your mind again. Listen now. They may still be in a prison, but the doors of that prison have been opened. And they don't know it. You do. There's not a single person who's far away from God, who doesn't believe in him, who sits in a cell that is still locked. The doors have been opened. Jesus did this. He gave his life. He gave his life as a ransom. The doors are open. All that that person needs is to see someone come along. It may be you and it may not be you, but it should very well be in our minds as Christians and in our minds as a church that what we are meant to be is people who live free so that those who believe they're still trapped can see that they also are freed by what God did. And then they also can put their trust in him. Then they also can come to believe in him. Then they can also say, you are my Lord, and they can walk out of those prison doors and be free and alive and live in the light instead of the dark misery. And that is what our church is for all together. And so this means for us that we are no longer to be content with people who are trapped unnecessarily, but instead we should be the bearers of the good news that because Jesus Christ was born for all and lived for all and died for all, that his freedom and his ransom has been captured for all. And that is very good news. That is what we get to bear into the world in this season of Christmas, in every day, and in every place we go. Is that good news? Amen, it is. I'm going to ask the musicians to come forward, and we're going to sing in just a moment about Jesus, who is our Redeemer. And as we sing those words, I want you to bear in mind, as those words flow from your mouth, that Jesus' freedom is for you and for the people that you love and care about and for the people that are all around you in the world. Before we sing, I want to ask you to pray with me. Let's do that. God, I thank you for Jesus. And I thank you that he came and gave his life to free us. And not only us, but all. God, I ask that each one of us, every time we come up against the things that hold us captive and bind us, that we would recall that you have already freed us. And that we are indeed liberated to walk in freedom. That we can leave behind every prison cell. That we can leave behind all that would hold us. And that we would walk in freedom with you. And then, God, I ask that you would also give us eyes, each one of us in this place and us as a church, to see the people around us as also the ones who you have freed. And we pray that you'd help use us to make that freedom known to people who don't know it as yet. And we ask for this in Jesus' name. Amen.